From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, she's been quiet about the push to impeach President Trump, but Michigan Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin now says it's time.
The idea that potentially the President of the United States reached out to a foreign leader and asked for dirt on an opponent is just beyond the pale.
Community mental health leaders alarmed over a piece of the new mental health budget.
What's at risk for me the most is the public mental health system.
Theater critic David Kiley says this week's world premiere from the Detroit Public Theater proves the company's importance.
It's really become very quickly in its fifth season a gem of Detroit.
Getting girls and women into skateboarding.
Don't be afraid to fall. Be excited every time you come. And don't be sad if you have a rough time, because it will get easier.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The rise of esports and why universities are embracing video game competitions. That's later in the program. But first, President Trump today confirmed, yes, he blocked aid to Ukraine a week before his call with Ukrainian President Zelensky when he pressured Zelensky to investigate Joe Biden. Today's development comes as more House Democrats are shifting their stance on impeachment proceedings. A group of seven freshman Democrats, all veterans of the military and of the nation's defense and intelligence agencies, wrote a piece in The Washington Post declaring if the allegations that President Trump used his position to pressure a foreign nation into investigating a political opponent, if those allegations are true, then, quote, we believe these actions represent an impeachable offense. Among the seven, Congresswoman Alyssa Slotkin of Michigan's 8th District. Congresswoman, there have been other Democrats pressing for impeachment through the Russia investigation, the Mueller probe. You were not one of those voices until now. Why is this beyond the pale for you?
You know, I think for me as a national security professional, there were so many times in my adult life, basically from the beginning of my career, that I took an oath to protect and defend the Constitution. I did the exact same thing back in January when I became a congresswoman. And there are times when, you know, you hear at least the allegations of something like this, and you just have to take a step back and say, if I don't do something, it's not living up to my oath. And, you know, a number of us were talking about it. I had been judicious about calling for impeachment. And I just think that the idea that potentially the President of the United States reached out to a foreign leader and asked for dirt on an opponent is just beyond the pale. And if he used American security assistance paid for by the American taxpayer to do it, to put that pressure, well, that's even worse. And if these allegations are true, then I think we're in a different world. So I just felt it was important to say it. And a number of us felt compelled to do it. And so we came out.
How difficult was that decision for you to join with your colleagues and come out so publicly?
Well, it's never an easy thing when you decide to come out on something. I mean, to be honest with you, the 8th District is a very independently minded district. We have lots of people who have called for impeachment. We have lots of people who are adamantly against it. I hear from lots of them on our phones and emails and letters and in my town halls. But I think many, many times in my life in a different world when I was a CIA officer or certainly at the Pentagon as an assistant secretary, you have to make hard calls sometimes, even if they're not popular. And this felt to me like one of those times. And so at the end of the day, I really hope I didn't take I didn't do it out of political calculus. I did it because I believe in it. And I think that you have to say that it's not okay for any American president to go to a foreign leader and ask for dirt to use in a political process. It's just, that can't be all right.
Have you been in line at the grocery store or the coffee shop and someone says, wait, he's our president, let him be?
To be honest, what folks are pulling me aside in the grocery store to ask about is when are we going to do things on things like the price of insulin or inhalers or EpiPens, pharmaceuticals, the price of healthcare. But certainly in calls to my office and in town halls, I get pushed to think about impeachment. But I also get people who will come up to me, you know, at a football game or, you know, at a job site that I'm visiting and saying, like, please don't do this. You know, we can have an election. So I hear the whole range because the 8th District is really independently minded. And that's a good thing.
What's at risk for you, for the Democratic Party, should Speaker Pelosi go ahead and move on impeachment?
Well, what's really important, and those of us with a service background have made this point, is we really need to bring the country along with us. And I am the first to acknowledge that the Democrats have not done a good job at that. We have been all over the place. You have all these separate committees launching all these separate investigations. And it's not like they're wrong to do it, but it hasn't been strategic, efficient, clear. And I think that's, to me, why it's important to focus on the national security implications of this latest allegation, because I think it's understandable. I think it's clear. And now our charge is to make sure that whatever process goes forward is set to a really high standard so that the country gets brought along with us. I think that's really, really important. And the risk is that we don't do a good job at that, whatever we do. And, I hope that the president provides clarification and documents so that maybe this wasn't the case. I would love that to be true. But whatever happens, we need to be clear and strategic. And the risk of not being so, I think, is pretty high.
The acting director of National Intelligence, Joseph McGuire, is slated to appear before the House Intelligence Committee on Thursday. So far, he is refusing to turn over the whistleblower complaint to Congress, even though the law requires that he does that. What should committee members ask him?
Well, first of all, he should bring the documents with him. That is the law. When I worked for the director of National Intelligence, we worked on the whistleblower law so that intelligence community officials had the same protections that anyone else in the federal government did. So I feel pretty strongly that any cabinet-level official in the United States should adhere to the law. He should provide it. Secondly, I want to hear his explanation for why the military assistance seems to have been delayed, what exactly the president did or did not do. I mean, the problem is the president's lawyer went on TV and said on live television that indeed he had reached out to the government of Ukraine. He had asked about information about a political opponent. So the onus is on the administration to clear that up. And I think the DNI is the first person who will be up on the Hill, should expect pretty tough questioning, because we have to have norms and standards. We have to make sure that the bones of democracy are strong, and those are our institutions.
Publicly, your Republican House colleagues have been either silent or supportive of the president. What about away from cameras and microphones? Is there anything you're hearing from any of them that leads you to think they're questioning the president after these new revelations?
Well, obviously, we know there's a number of folks who I work with a lot who are retiring. So I think for some folks, there is some level of exhaustion with just kind of the vitriol, and they have a hard time sort of speaking on behalf of the president. But I don't know what they're going to do. I very much hope that this isn't a partisan issue, and that if these allegations are true, that my colleagues across the political spectrum say, okay, you know what? There's just some times where you got to think about, what do you tell your grandkids about this behavior? What's okay and what's not okay in our system? And I very much hope that this isn't a partisan issue. I know that's a high bar, but that's still what I'm hoping.
Representative Alyssa Slotkin, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you.
When 9-year-old Emma Hernandez was mauled to death by 3 pit bulls last month, it put Detroit's animal care and control under a harsh, unforgiving spotlight, particularly the revolving door of directors, 3 directors in only the past 4 years. Well, now the city has hired a new director. He began his job Monday, and now the spotlight is being fixed on his track record, including the fact he was fired from his last job. Kat Stafford covers Detroit government for the Detroit Free Press. So, Kat, tell us, who's this new director, and where's he been working through his 30-year career in animal welfare?
So the city of Detroit just hired Mark Coombs. He came from the state of Ohio, where he was the director of the Montgomery County Animal Resource Center. He ran into a lot of controversy during his time there. He was just let go from his job at the end of December, and he faced a lot of criticism from various animal advocacy groups who said the shelter he was running had a very high euthanasia rate. So there has been a lot of concern raised with this new hire.
And certainly, I happen to notice there's a petition calling for his removal, and it has racked up nearly 6,500 signatures as you and I talk. And this is just his second day on the job.
Yes. And what a lot of people did was they went and looked into his background and kind of really resurfaced some of these old stories about his tenure there. He was named in a lawsuit in connection with the dog mauling death of a resident there in 2014. And this lawsuit is claiming negligence on his end as well as the shelter. So a lot of animal advocacy groups that are here in the city of Detroit are concerned, especially in light of the issues that we've seen in Detroit with the recent dog mauling death of Emma Hernandez.
Now, have you been able to talk with Mark Kumpf?
So yesterday, when I found out about this, I reached out to the city of Detroit. I asked if I could speak with him. He was not made available for comment. I was able to speak with the health department spokesperson, as well as a couple other city officials, but he has not yet spoken to the media.
So what are city officials saying? What's their reaction to this pushback?
Well, they're saying that they fully vetted his history. They're saying that he has already proposed a plan of action to improve services in the city of Detroit. And they're also saying that they're very confident. They're saying that this man has 30 years of experience in this industry and that he's going to bring a sense of security for residents as it relates to responding to a lot of these dangerous calls that we've seen in the headlines. But again, a lot of people are concerned. They really want this hire to be a good one. So a lot of people are saying, let's give him some time and see what he's able to do.
Yeah, in fact, I'm looking at the Facebook page for the Detroit Dog Rescue, and its director was put a post up there saying, in essence, hey, I have met with Mark Kumpf. Let's give the guy a chance. And it was an interesting comment she wrote. Detroit is hard. There aren't a million people lining up for the job.
Yes, and I had the opportunity to actually shadow Christina Millman Rinaldi, who is the executive director of Detroit Dog Rescue, and we kind of were on the front lines. We saw a lot of the hard calls that they have to respond to, and she has a point. This is a tough job. You're not just dealing with animal welfare. You're responding to calls that involve people. So she, like many others, just want to see someone good in this position, so she's kind of taking the stance, hey, let's hold off and see what he can do.
And we should note, I saw in your story, there has been more money earmarked for animal control. How much more?
So in light of a lot of the ongoing issues, Animal Control received a boost in funding earlier this year during the Detroit City Council's budget process. They went from about $2.6 million last year to nearly $3.3 million. So they've gotten some extra money. People are hoping that this means we'll see improvements at the animal shelter. And the city has also noted that they have brought on more animal care control officers, which is good because that means more boots on the ground in the community.
Kat Stafford, Detroit Free Press. Kat, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Coming up, as the legislature and the governor come up with new budgets for the next fiscal year, what's the plan for the state's public mental health system? That's next, right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Hundreds of thousands of Michiganders who have a mental illness or substance abuse disorder are untreated. That's according to a study that came out this summer. Meanwhile, the state's publicly funded mental health system has been struggling financially for years, and the private health plans say they can do a better job. As the legislature and governor come up with new budgets for the next fiscal year, what is the plan for the state's $2.6 billion Medicaid mental health system? Well, let's talk about this now as we welcome Bob Sheehan, Chief Executive Officer of the Community Mental Health Association of Michigan, and Julia Rupp, Executive Director of HealthWest, formerly known as Muskegon County Community Mental Health. Bob, I want to start with you. When we talk about the public mental health system, exactly what are we talking about?
Cindy, what we mean is the system that's been around since the 1960s to serve the mental health needs of the state, and it includes the 46 community mental health centers serving every county in the state, about 150 private providers who are part of the provider network, and 10 governmental public health plans that actually manage the Medicaid benefit.
And Julia Rupp, tell us about the people in the community you serve with HealthWest, and especially whether demand for your services has been changing in recent years.
In Muskegon County, we serve individuals from birth to death that have needs for mental health, substance use, or intellectual and developmental disabilities.
Have you seen an increase in demand?
Absolutely. With children, we've seen about a 25% increase in services, and we see an increasing need for adults with substance use disorders. 2 years ago, we were up 40%, and this year up another 25%.
Bob, is this increase in demand, is that typical across Michigan?
It is. It's happening statewide. I mean, the upside, Cindy, is that people are recognizing they have mental health needs or substance abuse needs. It's, you know, that's what we want people to do, to seek treatment. The problem is the financing, until this coming year, have not kept pace with that.
Yeah, so tell us a little more, to take us deeper into what you see as the overall financial situation of Michigan's public mental health system.
Well, it's been pretty dire. Our association published a report several weeks ago that talked about a convergence of factors from 2014 on, everything from increased demand with Healthy Michigan, Medicaid expansion, the opioid crisis and the demand from that, the beginning of an autism benefit for the first time in Michigan's history, and then a large cut in state general fund financing, non-Medicaid, that happened in 2014. So those four or five things put our system in the hole by about $100 million every year for the last several years.
Julia, when you look at Health West's budget, how has it looked in the last few years?
This fiscal year that will be ending in September 30th, we will have expenses over revenue of about $6 million. We had something very similar last year, and that's all due to increased need.
And so what does that mean for you?
Well, it means that, unfortunately, the county is operating as our bank right now, and we're waiting for cost settlement in order to be able to make us whole. We continue to provide the services that are being demanded, and individuals meet the eligibility criteria, so we have to provide the service, as we should. But that means that we have to use local dollars while we're waiting for cost settlement.
And so, Bob, as you look at this budget proposal that is, you know, chewing its way through the legislature, what are your thoughts?
There's good and bad to it. So the financing part is actually quite good. The state, we want to applaud the state. Actually, they have a sizable increase in Medicaid financing, which is 95% of our budgets, our members' budgets, increased autism funding, substance abuse treatment funding. It's quite impressive. The downside is called Section 298, and I can go into further depth if you want me to with that one, Cindy.
Yes, please.
So Section 298 is a language in the budget bill. This last 2 years, it was to form a set of pilots, of which Julia's CMH is one of the pilot sites. But the language that appeared just last week in the Senate and House bill guts the basic principles of that pilot. It, first of all, makes an evaluation midway through the pilot, calls on the state to actually begin full implementation across the whole state of what's called a carve-in, regardless of what the pilot says. And so the pilot's a three-year pilot, but a year in, it'll truncate that and want the state to make a decision about going full bore. Secondly, it allows the health plans who are part of this pilot to go around the CMH system and purchase services from any provider. And that tends to mean low-cost providers with no experience with our population who are bring very complex needs to the table. And then thirdly, the whole premise of the pilots was to bring savings in health care because of the need to provide mental health care early on reduces physical health care costs. And the premise was to move those physical health care savings into the mental health side. The budget language says, no, not until all the costs of the health plans in making this transition are covered will the savings be transferred. So we would expect, with that language, no savings to be transferred.
So as we talk about the budget and problems, we have to dig into these pilot projects and the fact that private health plans have been arguing they can do a better job. They can deliver mental health care for Medicaid patients more effectively and efficiently than the state-run system. To that, Bob, what do you say? Give me your elevator pitch response.
Sure. Our system has a long history of a well-developed system. The health plans don't. We provide traditional and non-traditional care, meaning home-based care and the use of peers. They don't do that. Our overhead is low. Our overhead is 6%. The health plan's overhead is 15%. There's no profit drawn out from our system. All the money, if it's saved, is reinvested in services. And in every community, we are the local safety net. By law, people come to expect our system to be there for them. That's not true for a health plan. It's a private market. They can withdraw from the system anytime they want.
And to find a way forward in this debate, these pilot projects we've been talking about, they were set up between a few health plans and a few public providers. And Health West has been part of one of these. Julia, how long have you been at it, and where are you with the pilot now?
We have been meeting with health plans and the department for over 2 years. We have made a substantial amount of progress. There's no doubt that the health plans, as well as the CMHs, didn't realize how complicated this was going to be. But we've made quite a lot of progress. I agree with Bob that the health plans cannot do a better job than our public behavioral health system. However, the reason we got into this pilot is to improve outcomes for the people that we serve through better coordinated care. Also agree with Bob that we need to look at the evaluation before we start to think about expanding it. 20 months is not enough time to be able to evaluate the outcomes. So to talk about full implementation seems premature. Secondly, one of the major motivators to be part of this was the reinvestment of savings into the system to improve services to our community. If they take all those dollars and allow the health plans to use it for startup costs, that's a problem.
Hmm.
With that said, at this point in time, we're still fully committed to the pilot and moving forward, and we're just going to wait and see what happens with this budget.
So you do see room to collaborate with the health plans?
We see room to collaborate. However, these issues in the boilerplate are a problem.
So as this debate's gone on, there has been a criticism that the public sector has not been as efficient in using funds as that the private sector may be. What do you say to that, Julia?
I'd say that there are no facts to support that. The only fact they have is overspending of our allocation, but by the admission of the own department's actuarials, we're underfunded.
Yeah, so it's not a matter of overspending, it's underfunding.
Correct.
So, Bob, what do you see? What is the way forward in your view?
So we're asking House and Senate leadership to today, actually, work to change that budget bill, to take the language that's so damaging to our system and our clients. Failing that, we're asking the governor to veto those sections. If neither of those things happen, we have a mess on our hands. The pilots can't go forward. These three things are real poison pills to moving forward. I mean, you and I might actually think maybe they were put in as poison pills, but I don't think so. I think they were put in to truncate the negotiations and move to an outcome that the health plans wanted, but is not in the benefit of our system nor the people we serve.
You know, you use the term poison pill, Bob, so put this in context. If the legislature passes and Governor Whitmer signs the budget bill as written, what would it mean for Michigan's public mental health system moving forward?
Well, in the three pilot communities, it would be a disaster for the CMHs and those served. It would allow the health plans to purchase from anybody that they wanted to services. Someone who couldn't spell mental health last week could open a shop and be contracted with. That's a concern because the CMHs have really drawn together the best talent in their communities. Secondly, if the savings don't move over, the CMHs will end up spending more money to bring out healthcare integration with no savings. And then thirdly, very quickly, as Julia said, halfway through the pilot, the boilerplate says the state will make a decision to go statewide. And so you've made a decision to go statewide, which we've seen as a disaster across the country, without running the pilot, which was the intent of the pilot. So I think it means serious questions about whether the pilot can continue if that language is passed.
Julia, where do you want to see things go from here?
Well, better care for our clients. How we get there, better outcomes, I think that I'm open to see what that's going to look like. We obviously thought that 298 was an opportunity to achieve those things. And this new language in the budget is unfortunate. I'm hopeful that we can address that so that we can move forward with the pilot.
What do you think was behind this change in language, this legislative language that, Bob, you're saying it would basically gut the system?
Well, the change is actually the same theme that kicked off this whole thing, 298, back in 2015. So 4 years ago, the health plans put forward language in the boilerplate that said in a year, the whole place will be privatized. All the CMH payments will be moving through the private health plans because it's lucrative. It's a $2.5 billion business. And this is that language is just, you can see the same themes in this set of boilerplate statements. So that's what's behind it, is the desire to capture a $2.5 billion market.
Do you see an appeal to the governor? Who's there that's hearing you try to sound this alarm?
We have many allies in the House and Senate who are hearing this, and the governor's office is hearing it too. And so we have allies across the board. To be somewhat frank, though, it is difficult to push against a well-financed political campaign by the health plans. Their political contributions are 27 times higher, the public system. So, it dwarfs that. So we have to use the public voice and the voice of our clients to speak out. And it's being heard, and we're just calling on the governor and the House and Senate leadership to be courageous and make these changes.
Julia Rupp, you are on the ground in Muskegon County servicing clients. What's at stake here?
What's at risk for me the most is the public mental health system. I think that our work with the plans over the last several months has helped them to understand the role and the importance of community mental health. I don't necessarily think that they're trying to sabotage or eliminate the CMH system.
But this language in boilerplate does that. And that would be disastrous for the consumers that we serve.
For people who are listening to us talk, Bob Sheehan, who's perhaps they have not intersected with the mental health system, explain why this matters.
Our system serves over 300,000 Michiganders every year, and they serve we serve the most severely in need. So people who have schizophrenia or severe substance use disorders or intellectual developmental disabilities, people who are really on the margins of our society. We run towards them and serve them, help them with housing and employment and treatment and access to medications, primary care. That's what's at risk. We're one of the 20-some states in the country who have a county-based system that is far different than the private sector system. It actually is a safety net that communities work on. And the story I always use, Cindy, is that when something happens in town and the sheriff wants mental health care, they call their CMH director. When the school principal needs that, they call the CMH director. When the county commissioner, the city mayor, that isn't true. They don't call their private health insurance for that. And so that's the difference. They know who to call because it's a public utility and it's reliable. This breaks down that reliability and puts it on the private market. The private market's a good thing in America, but it's not good for serving poor and vulnerable folks who don't have better access. So that's what we're talking about.
Bob Sheehan, Chief Executive Officer of the Community Mental Health Association of Michigan, and Julia Rupp, who's Executive Director of Health West in Muskegon County. We want to thank you both for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
A brief note. We have spoken at length about these proposed changes to Michigan's mental health system with Dominic Pallone. He represents the private health plans, including most recently in June. You'll find a link to that interview in today's web post at the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. Skate parks in movies and TV shows tend to have a certain vibe, a little grungy, a lot of graffiti, filled with teenage boys in baggy shorts. You're unlikely to see many women skaters. But a program at the Ann Arbor Skate Park is working to change that image and bring more girls into the sport. Since 2014, All Girls Skate has welcomed kids of all ages to try their hand at skateboarding. They offer all the instruction and equipment you need to get started for free. Stateside's Bella Isaacs-Thomas visited the skate park and saw the girls in action.
1, 2, 3, eyes on me!
1, 2, eyes on you!
Awesome! My name's Lucy, I'm 14, and I've been skating since I was 3. Well, when I first started skating, I was usually the only girl there, and that was really, like, tough, because it was, like, all teenage boys and, like, 30-year-old men. And that was very intimidating to me.
Very good.
Now we're gonna go 3, 2, 1, and you're gonna hit hard, okay? 3, 2, 1, hard, Quinn. Woo!
So my name's Quinn, and I've been skating for 4 or 5 years now. What I like about All Girls Skate is that it's kind of free, like you're allowed to do whatever.
My name's Izzy. I like to skate. And go down the ramps.
My name's Chuck. My daughter is Izzy, and we're from Lansing. We've been bringing her since June, middle of June, probably. So far, so good. Yeah, I mean, she's 4, so.
Yeah, you're wanting to go fast, but you won't like holding hands.
It holds her attention. I can say we're going to all-girls skate, and she gets excited. So, I mean, that's what's most important. And I've been skating like 25 years, so to have something to be able to share with my daughter is amazing.
My name is Crystal Gail Partington. I am on the board for the Ann Arbor Skate Park, and I have been with this kind of grassroots effort since day one. It's quite an investment sometimes to go and get helmets and pads and all that, and especially a nice skateboard. And the coolest thing I think about the All-Girl Skate is that we have all the equipment and the gear here for them. So everything you need to just drop in and try it out. Almost, almost. I think skateboarding has always been like a growing sport. And I think now, you know, it's been primarily all guys and whatnot, you know, so people think. But I think it's been really amazing just to see these little girls, like, come in. You know, they kind of get together, rage together, and then when they try something new, just, like, seeing how excited they are.
All right, girls, let's bring it back in. I love the girls. Like, I've been with some of them for, like, 2.5 years, and you know, it's just been awesome to work with them. All right, Reese, you want to go? What's one thing you did really well?
I went down the stairs.
That's definitely amazing. No matter how old you are, how young you are, you can of course get into skating, you know? Don't be afraid to fall. Be excited every time you come. And don't be sad if you have a rough time, because it will get easier. Before you leave, you gotta give me some high fives, okay?
High five!
Everybody did so well today. Okay, two, let's see how high you can jump. 3, 2, 1, go. Woo, very good. Yeah, of course.
Coming up, Michigan Tech preparing to make playing video games a varsity-level team sport.
We may be the first public institution in Michigan to be doing this, but there are several universities across the country who are adding it at the varsity level.
That story coming up on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Detroit Public Theater is launching its fifth season, and from the very start, the DPT has focused on groundbreaking plays, often by writers with deep Michigan ties. And that's the case with this week's premiere of Paradise Blue, a Detroit story from Dominique Morisseau, who's a Detroit-born actor and writer, finding success in both coasts, in New York and in Hollywood. David Kiley of Encore Michigan is here with our latest edition of Theater Talk. So what is Paradise Blue about?
This is the third play in sort of a Detroit project, a trilogy of plays that that Morisseau has written. And this is set in 1949 in the Paradise Valley neighborhood of Detroit.
And we should remind people, Black Bottom and Paradise Valley were the historic black neighborhoods for Detroit.
Right. So the plot is about a character named Blue. He's sort of a troubled trumpeter, and he's the owner of a place called the Paradise Club. And he's torn between remaining in the Black Bottom neighborhood with his loyal lover, whose name is Pumpkin, and leaving behind a past that he finds kind of traumatic, or, you know, versus going away and kind of getting away from his past. So we were able to talk to Courtney Burkett, the producing artistic director for the Detroit Public Theater, about this play and kind of how it fits, what it's about and how it fits in a trilogy.
I want people to understand what happened in our city. So I want people to know that Paradise Valley was here, that there was a community and there was a lot of strength in that community and it was destroyed, and to really ask themselves how and why this happened. And to really think about, as we go forward, as we change as a city, what we want to preserve and how we want to change.
This really is a theater that's been pushing and to do really high-level work, isn't it?
It is. It's really become, very quickly in its fifth season, a gem of Detroit. And we just handed out our Wild Awards, and we gave their production of The Beauty Queen of Lynn Anne, the Irish play, the best play of last season for a drama. They're doing very high-level work. We reported a few months ago that a show that premiered 2 years ago, Birthday Candles, going to Broadway this spring. And this play, this is a very important play. This whole trilogy is very important with a major playwright in Dominique Morisseau.
Now we go to Ann Arbor and Theater Nova. What's on stage there? You're smiling.
I am smiling because I like this theater and I like this play, which I'm hoping to see this weekend, but one of our other critics saw it and liked it very much. It's called Admissions. And being in a big college town like we are, It resonates. It had its premiere last year, but it seems to me, it's one of those plays that feels like it's ripped from the headlines. It's about a young man, white, who is waitlisted or deferred after applying to an Ivy League school. And his additional conflict in all of this is that he knows a student of mixed race that he doesn't think is as strong a student as he is. And he got in on the first take. And the white character, he's parents of privilege. His father works for a prestigious private school. This story should and does to me seem like a very strong creative commentary on two stories. The recent one in which wealthy people, including some of Hollywood's elite, were found to be paying middlemen to falsify student records for their kids or bribing college officials at prestigious colleges. The actress Felicity Huffman is going to jail for a short time for her role in trying to scam her daughter into USC. And then there's here in Ann Arbor, and there's the Gratz versus Bollinger case that went to the Supreme Court and centered on the University of Michigan's affirmative actions admissions policy. The university previously awarded points towards admission for underrepresented minorities, and the court ruled against the university and in favor of the plaintiff. So there's a lot going on in this play for the Ann Arbor theater-going community.
Well, for any Michigander who's got, you know, we've a lot of folks with a stake in that kind of issue with college admissions, and that's admissions at Theater Nova in Ann Arbor. And now we head over to Wayne County again and to the Tipping Point in Northville.
Right. They're doing a play called A Doll's House Part 2. So Henrik Ibsen, who wrote A Doll's House, did not write this play. Okay. This actually was written a few years ago. But it's an interesting play in that it picks up exactly where Ibsen's Dollhouse left off. And it is said of A Doll's House that it has the most famous door slam in theater. It comes at the end. And the play picks up with the characters right after that, Nora and Torvald. And it's a very good modern drama, picks up on a classic with terrific actors, including Inga Wilson and Ann Arbor's John Seibert, who also teaches at Eastern University.
All right. And now, speaking of Michigan playwrights, the way we began, The Purple Rose in Chelsea is doing a world premiere of a play from someone you call one of Michigan's very best playwrights.
He absolutely is. That's David McGregor. He wrote a Sherlock Holmes play last season for The Rose, and it was so successful that the theater commissioned two more Holmes plays to make it a full trilogy. I'm seeing it this Friday, but I can tell you that this last play that he wrote last season was delightful. Lots of fun sword play, wit, fabulous costumes, scenic design. I mean, my hopes are very high for this, seeing it this weekend.
And what is it called?
It's called The Sherlock Holmes and the Adventure of the Fallen Soufflé. And last year it was sort of Sherlock Holmes and the case of the missing ear. And so Van Gogh played a role in that. Okay. So I'm curious to see how this story unfolds.
Fun. And then just to get everybody all kind of prepped for Halloween, zombies.
That's right. The Halloween pop-up stores are up. So, yeah, Evil Dead.
Legend has it that it was written by the Dark Ones. Necronomicon Ex Mortis. Roughly translated, Book of the Dead.
This is the zombie play, which is also a musical.
We're all jammed in the car, and we're going really far.
Lots of blood and guts and zombie fun. It's back at the City Theater. This is in Detroit. It's sort of an annual thing. I won't give away too much. There's a bit of audience participation. Don't wear your nice clothes. It's a play based on the movie of the same name. And if zombie culture is your thing, this is very good and fun production in Detroit. They do it very well every year.
We're five college students on our way to an old abandoned cabin in the woods. Oh, yeah!
As always, you can find details of these and other productions all around the state. Just go to EncoreMichigan.com. David Kiley, many thanks.
Thanks so much, Cynthia.
Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. And time for our friendly reminder. We love hearing from you, finding out what stories you're focusing on or issues or people that you want to hear more about on this program. Let us know. You can find us on Facebook, search for Michigan Radio. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio, and of course, always MichiganRadio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. There will soon be a new way to compete in sports at the varsity level at Michigan Technological University. Beginning in 2020, Michigan Tech will become the first public university in our state to offer esports at the varsity level. Planning is now underway for this new addition to the Michigan Tech Huskies. With us now is Suzanne Sandregret, who's the director of athletics at Michigan Tech. Welcome to Stateside.
Thank you, Cynthia.
So getting everybody on the same page, exactly what are we talking about when we say esports?
Well, esports is virtual gaming, and it's one of the fastest growing trends in collegiate athletics, and it certainly is an exploding field of competition internationally as well.
Who actually had the idea first to say, hey, you know what, let's do this here at Michigan Tech?
Well, there are several other colleges and universities across the country that are offering esports and gaming. Not all of them are housed in athletics. Some are housed in student affairs and student activities, and some are even housed in academic units. So we've been watching this phenomenon, I guess, across the country for 2 or 3 years, and it seemed very appropriate after some further research on our campus, polling of our students, and working with our administration that this was a really solid fit for Michigan Technological University being a leading STEM university in the country. So that's the planning started about two to three years ago, and we really got much more organized over the summer and then announced in the middle of August that we were going to launch a varsity program.
And why a varsity program, let's say, as opposed to, as you mentioned, some schools have it in student affairs, others have it maybe within the College of Computing. Why varsity?
Well, the reason is I think we can gain a lot of marketing and exposure related to it. There's a lot of potential students out there in the world that are interested in gaming. And by making it a varsity sport and offering scholarships makes it very attractive. So we're hoping that it assists with enrollment. But I think more importantly, it provides, by housing esports in athletics, it provides an avenue for us to provide some pretty significant support services to these future student athletes in the realm of academic support and mental well-being.
Just as you do for your football players, your hockey players, it's all part of the package.
Exactly. We will treat our esports student athletes similar to traditional sports student athletes and provide similar services and support.
Was there anyone in the university community kind of resistant to this idea who had to be won over?
Well, I think that esports and gaming is somewhat of a polarizing topic. I think either you really understand and get it and understand why it's appropriate or you don't. But we do have a lot of faculty and staff on campus that are very interested in gaming. It's part of their classroom environment, especially in the College of Computing, related to software development and gaming development. So there was a lot of support for the program from faculty. In fact, we already have a Husky Game Development is one of our enterprise programs, and we also have several student organizations, Gamers Anonymous, that have already been competing nationally throughout the years. So I have not had very much, if any, negative feedback. It's all been very positive, and I think that it's a real service to our students, and it's thinking about what our students for this next generation are going to want to be a part of, and it certainly matches.
How many will be on the team?
So we hope to start competing in the fall of 20, and we will phase in over that time maybe 20 or so on the roster, and hopefully by year 3 and 4 we'll have about 60 students as part of our team, some at the varsity level or the competition level, maybe some at the JV level who would be considered subs, and then we hope to have some other students involved with the technology side of things and strategy side of the game.
How do seasons and competitive matches work in esports? I mean, we all pretty well get, the college year in football, but how does it work in esports?
Well, esports can be year-round. We will limit it to fall and spring semesters, and it's going to depend also on the games that we select. We may select anywhere from 4 to 6 games that we compete in, and then the competitions will be national, and most of them will be played virtually with very minimal travel.
It strikes me as you say that budget-wise, this can be kinder to the school's budget when you don't have all the travel costs involved.
Exactly, and it also reduces missed class time. You know, one of the factors that we considered is that about 70% of our students on campus identify as gamers or identify that they do play video games on a regular basis. So we know that this is really attractive of across campus. And I think I want to add that our support of these students by bringing them in-house, and maybe to some of the naysayers, is that we can support them to help better balance their time between academics and self-care with video games. So we're able to support them mentally, physically, and hopefully create a more well-balanced student. And I think that in the long term, that's going to really assist with retention and graduation rates of that population.
Suzanne, I'm just curious, are you hearing anything from alumni or donors who kind of wonder whether esports is worth all the time and money the university is going to put into it? I mean, how do you convince people who are skeptics who say, come on, sitting at a computer playing online video games, how is that on a level with football or hockey?
Well, it is different, and it is not one of your traditional sports. But I think if anyone watches ESPN now, you're going to see that some of the fastest growing sports that are being watched are related to esports. And I think you could also look at other non-traditional type sports that ESPN is showing, like the national cornhole tournaments or NASCAR racing and things like that. So there's a lot of variety of competition out there. And I think you have to look at it more from the competitive part, the teamwork side of things, the strategy involved with gaming, the problem solving, the communication. And those are all very transferable things from one sport to another, whether it's our traditional sports or something new like esports. There may not be the physical component in the actual competition, but there certainly is a lot of the mental aspect that goes into it.
How about the recruiting process? Any recruits that you have your eye on?
Not at this point. I am actually going to be hiring a director of esports. And at that point in time, that individual will be in charge of recruitment. We do have some leads on some students. We've actually been contacted by several potential students and some current students that would like to be a part of it. But in terms of the actual evaluation of the talent, I'm going to leave that up to the director slash head coach, just like I would any other sport.
What kind of conversations, Suzanne, are you having with other athletic directors in Michigan or the upper Midwest or elsewhere in the country? I'm wondering, is there a growing interest, or are they going to kind of watch and wait and see, how you're doing it at Michigan Tech and use you as a guinea pig?
Well, I think it is more and more athletic directors are discussing it. We certainly are not. We may be the first public institution in Michigan to be doing this, but there are several universities across the country who are adding it at the varsity level. It is an emerging sport, so there's still a lot to be worked out in terms of protocol. But athletic directors, we're talking about it. We're actually hoping to have a conference championship in esports in the GLIAC, which is predominantly a Michigan-based athletic conference that our traditional sports play in. So it's something that is attractive because it hits and impacts and interests a whole nother set of students that may be interested in your university. And again, it matches so well with Michigan Tech with our STEM focus.
What kind of career might players expect after college? I mean, could people go pro in this?
Absolutely, they could be professional, but I think just like our traditional sports student athletes, most of them do not turn professional and pursue a career in the degree program area that they've studied. So at Michigan Tech, we're probably looking at a lot of software engineers and computer engineers and that type of thing. So we anticipate that more of them will lean towards those careers versus a professional career in gaming. But you never know. You may find a diamond in the rough.
Suzanne Sandregret, who's Director of Athletics at Michigan Technological University, the Houghton School, will become the first public university in Michigan to offer a varsity esports program. It'll kick off in the fall of 2020. Suzanne, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
A Detroit man has been jailed in China since 2016. He was accused of assaulting a local man at a bar, a charge he has denied for more than 3 years. Chinese authorities have finally released Wendell Brown, and tomorrow he returns home to his family. We'll have his story tomorrow on Stateside. Today's Stateside was directed by Mercedes Mejia and engineered by Peg Watson. Our executive producer is Joe Lindstroth. Contributors are Mike Blank, April Van Buren, Laura Weber-Davis, Adam Reyes, and Bella Isaacs-Thomas.
I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening.